Hey, Renter Retires, it's Adam Schrader here with another episode. And today we are bringing on Jason Veeley. He is a real estate investor who has invested in some standard things and some not so standard things. So, Jason, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, man, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to start, obviously, with the beginning. But before you were a real estate investor, you worked in corporate America, and then you decided, you know what, I need to do something else. And the interesting thing to me is you actually were a licensed financial advisor. And usually those people don't, in my experience, don't go the route of real estate. So what led you to go down the path of real estate while you were working in corporate America?
Yeah. So I went to school for finance and got my bachelor's from UNC Wilmington. And then I went and got licensed as a financial advisor. And did that for several months. But I learned really quickly that, at least with the firm that I worked at, it was not a job of investments and educating people, helping them understand their finances. It was 100% a sales job. And that wasn't really what I thought that I was signing up for. And I was doing fine. I was exceeding the goals that they, had for me, but I just didn't like it. I just felt sleazy that I wasn't really making an impact or doing anything valuable. I was just selling. And so I switched over to institutional trust funds. And then from there, the real estate stuff just kind of started as a side thought that I knew that you could be wealthy in retirement if you just bought one rental here and there and you slowly saved up money for a down payment and you bought one. And then maybe by the time you're, 60, 65, you've got 20 or 30 of them that are paid off and you can be wealthy in retirement. But it was as I was trying to buy my first rental that somebody else introduced me to another big real estate podcast. And from there, I learned about things like private lenders and hard money lenders. And my mind just exploded and I saw the opportunity. And so that's whenever I kind of leaned a little more heavily into the real estate stuff. But I still had to, I've got a wife and four kids now with our fifth on the way. So I had to be careful about how I did it and making sure risks were calculated and made sure that I didn't, plan to leave the day job until we had enough net pure passive rental cash flow coming in to cover all of our expenses. So that if I couldn't flip any more houses in a, really down market for a couple of years or so, we would still be safe.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about that very first deal with, and especially with your family situation, kind of how did you, was your wife on board? Was she hesitant? How'd you get her on board if she wasn't? Tell us a little bit about that first experience.
Sure. So the very first property that I bought was supposed to be a rental property, and the numbers looked good on paper, but I had no construction background, and I hired the cheapest flat rate home inspector that I could find that missed everything that he should have found too. So as far as my wife goes, she didn't have a great feeling about that first property, but she trusted me and allowed me to, do, what I felt was right. And I also explained to her that, look, we're buying this house for so cheap that worst case scenario with the tiny mortgage that we're getting on this, our monthly principal, interest, tax, and insurance payment altogether is going to be $351 a month. So absolute worst case scenario, we're going to have to float that $351 a month, which, yeah, we didn't want to have to do, but we could handle that without it being, detrimental to our family. So that's what we did. I found that property on Craigslist and negotiated a little bit better deal, and I thought I was getting a great deal. And turns out I had no idea how to inspect a property. I didn't find all the mold inside of the kitchen cabinets because they looked great from the outside, and I didn't find the termites, and I didn't see that the whole roof actually needed to be replaced. And my home inspector missed all of those things too. I thought I was being, safe by paying for a home inspection, and turned out it was just in terrible condition. We weren't able to rent it out. And we ended up having to sit on that property for around 2 years and float that payment until we had some cash built up to be able to pay another contractor to go in and fix it up the right way, because the original contractor I had also ended up ripping us off for $16,000. So I really jumped in and, you know, was trial by fire, you know, fed to the wolves at the beginning, whatever cliche you want to use. But that first deal was rough, and it was a big learning experience. But, you know, as we all know, real estate is very forgiving with time. And, you know, over those 2 years, the market appreciated fairly well. So at the end of the day, after paying for the new contractor to go in and fix everything up, I sold it at a price that I basically broke even. I basically got my, you know, purchase price plus all that rehab money back. But the good news is I found my next deal, which became my first intentional flip, the very next month after I bought that first deal, before I knew how bad of a deal it was. So I'm kind of grateful that it happened that quickly, or otherwise I may not have ever tried to, you know, do a second deal. And that's that second deal, which was that first flip, which was a double wide trailer on land, ended up going very, very well. And then I just had my proof of concept and kept going from there.
Now, you mentioned having, you know, you not noticing some things, your inspector missing some things, getting ripped off by the first contractor. Tell us, how did you learn from those? I mean, obviously, you can learn from those, be like, well, I never want to get ripped off like that again. But tell us some practical lessons of what you used from that experience to make yourself better on the, you know, upcoming deals.
Yeah, for sure. Several things. I would say, you know, to anybody just starting doing your first deal, you know, don't do what I did and look for the cheapest price home inspector. You know, the guy I used charged a flat $300 fee, no matter what the size of the property was. That should have been my first red flag. You know, go to the realtor friends that you have and say, hey, when you're selling a property, who's the home inspector that you hate for the buyer on the other side to have? Who's the home inspector that picks apart the property and gives you all the headache when you're the one trying to sell the property? That's probably the home inspector that you want on your team representing you. And, you know, I would also say, not only if you're starting, not only have a good recommended home inspector, but take somebody else with you that is an experienced investor in your area, somebody that's done a good handful of deals, that knows what they're looking at, or at the very least a trusted contractor, whether it's, you know, a family friend or whoever, you know, because they're the ones that are going to know that you need to look inside of the cabinets, you need to look for drains underneath the sinks, you need to look for, you know, polybutylene plumbing, you know, coming up, you know, under the sinks and the vanities and whatnot. Little things like that that could be major expenses for you. Having somebody with a little bit of experience could really help you save a lot of headache in the long run.
So you had a property, and then you got, you said, a double wide. I mean, those are two very different asset classes. Why did you go into both of those?
Yeah, so in my area, manufactured homes, you know, single wides and double wides on land are very common. There are a lot of neighborhoods around here with double wides, a lot of them that are 20 and 30 years old, and there's a lot of opportunity. They're very easy to work on. The price is lower, so your overall barrier to entry is lower, you know, whether it's how much money you need to bring to the table or how much you need to borrow. And for me, I knew that space well enough because I lived in that area and I lived in that same exact neighborhood in a double wide myself at that time. So I knew the area like the back of my hand. I knew exactly what the house was worth as soon as the seller reached out to me. And, you know, I've learned since then that most real estate investor flippers in this area, at least, they don't touch manufactured homes. And one of the biggest reasons for that is a lot of them, after I talked to them, and they're asking me, well, who are you selling these to? Are you just selling to people buying them for cash for cheap? And they don't realize that if it's on a permanent foundation, you know, deeded with the land as real estate, as real property, if somebody's buying it as their primary residence, they can get all the same types of normal financing as a stick-built house. So you can get conventional FHA, USDA, VA, et cetera. And so with a lot of folks not knowing that, there's so much less competition. So I may have several wholesalers in my area that I might not be their top buyer on their list because they know that I'm only going to buy great deals. And they might have somebody next door, another buyer, that's going to be willing to pay an extra $5,000 or $10,000 or $15,000 more than I will. So they may go to them with all the stick built deals, but that same buyer probably doesn't want to touch the manufactured homes. And so even if I'm not at the top of their list for all of their properties, I'm still often going to be the top of the list for the manufactured homes. So I'm able to get great deals and a lot more deal flow by going that route.
So how did you find the first one of those? Was it just you were driving by and saw a sign? Because, I mean, you mentioned the real estate podcast. I mean, very, very few of them out there are talking about, you know, flipping mobile homes. I mean, there might be some more today, but you know, a few years ago, that wasn't really a thing. Were you just driving by a lot and saw a sign for it? Were you on a forum and just saw a wholesaler mention it? How did the thought even come into your head?
Yeah, so truthfully, some of it was ignorance, that I didn't know that it was any different from a stick-built house as far as like the ability to flip it or the ability to get a hard money loan for it, things like that. I had just learned from this podcast that there are hard money lenders out there. And it took me a long time when I got that one under contract to find a hard money lender that was willing to lend on a manufactured property, but they are out there. And I ended up finding one that gave me 100% of purchase and rehab, even though I had no experience and even though it was a manufactured home. But to answer
your... You get such great terms on it, though.
Yeah, it was kind of expensive. I think it was like 3.5 points up front and 12% interest. So it was pretty expensive, but hey, it got the deal done. But to answer your question on how I found it, it's funny. I actually, my wife and I, we used to take the kids for a walk every evening in that neighborhood when we lived there. And there was this one house that we always saw that was a double wide with overgrown grass and the mailbox was taped shut. It was clearly vacant and the grass was mowed maybe like once a quarter. And I took a picture of that property. Well, first I tried to look up the owner and I couldn't find good contact information for the actual owner. And so I took a picture of that property and I went on our neighborhood Facebook group that only had, I don't know, 70 or 80 people in it. And I said, hey, does anybody know, you know, who owns this property? I'd love to see if they're interested in selling because clearly it's vacant. And nobody actually gave me the answer to that question. But because I made that post, somebody else in the neighborhood private messaged me and said, hey, we're on the next street over and we're about to move in with my mother-in-law because she's legally blind and, you know, needs help and we can't handle both mortgage payments. Would you like to, come look at ours? And then, you know, I asked what they were asking for it. And she said $65,000. And I knew ARV after repair value was at least 120. So I figured, okay, it would have to be in pretty terrible condition for me to say no. So that's when I scheduled an appointment. I went and looked at it. I calculated a $10,000 rehab budget. I negotiated the price down $5,000 to $60,000. Did the $10,000 rehab using hard money. Total hard money cost for holding it for several months because the contracts fell through several times. Points and interest, the hard money lender made about 11 grand off of me. But when I sold it, even after all of that, my net profit was a little over 26 grand on that first flip with only a $10,000 rehab.
Nice. That'll work. So tell us the difference. You know, you rehabbed the first property that you ended up selling and basically breaking even. You rehabbed, you know, the other one. what are the similarities and differences of rehabbing homes versus the, you know, the mobile homes that you have?
They're not that different. You know, there's obviously a big difference between a home that's on a slab versus a home that's on a crawl space, and manufactured homes are going to be very similar to homes that are on a crawl space. It's just, instead of being built on site, they're built somewhere else and then transported to the site and put on the, you know, the usually cinder block piers. So usually manufactured homes will have big steel I-beams underneath the floor joists, and those big I-beams sit on top of the piers. But as far as working on them goes, a lot of contractors that I know have argued that manufactured homes are even easier to work on than stick-built houses because stuff is easier to access. The only one part with that, you know, from the underside, if you need to go in the crawl space to do plumbing work of any sort, is that there's usually insulation between the floor joists and then a plastic underbelly underneath there. So you might have to cut open that plastic underbelly to gain access to what you need to see. But then you just, you know, you tack it back up and it's as good as new. But there's a pretty common issue with the manufactured homes that were built from the late 80s to the early 90s, though, that almost all of them in that time frame were plumbed with polybutylene plumbing, which is a usually indicated by a gray color pipe. So if you're looking at buying one in that age range, you know, go look under the kitchen sink and the vanity sink and look at the water supply lines coming up. And if they're gray, it's probably polybutylene, and you're probably going to have several leaks under the house. And that stuff, once it gets that 20, 30 years old, it's so fragile, it's so brittle that the second you repair one leak, you've created three more leaks by moving something. And that's why almost every home inspector is going to give you a problem with that if you don't change that plumbing. If you have it, if you leave it there and go to resell it, you're going to have an issue with the home inspector and or the buyer's agent. So just for reference, and I'm in North Carolina, you know, my retail priced plumbers are probably going to charge around $6,000 to replumb a double wide. And my, you know, much cheaper contractor options, I can get it done for around $3,000.
Okay. So talk about scaling your portfolio. I mean, you just started this investing journey within the last few years, I believe, and you've scaled up to, you know, a substantial portfolio. How are you, you know, what do you attribute your success to, and kind of walk us through a little bit of your journey there?
Absolutely. So I would say my business model from day one has been flip single family houses and then take the capital that I make from that and use it as down payments on multifamily. And people ask me all the time, well, why aren't you burying all of these, you know, flips that you're doing, all these single families? And, you know, for if there's any listeners that don't know, BRRRR stands for buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. And that's a very popular method where you buy a single family house, you fix it up, you put a tenant in there, and then go to the bank and say, hey, now I've got this rental income too. And it helps you qualify to get a loan to refinance your money back out. Well, the two issues with that is, number one, you can't get investment property loan on a manufactured home. You can get it as your primary residence all day long, no problem. But investment property, a rental, you can't. So those don't make for a good BRRRR option. And the second reason is that when you look at the, going back to, you know, my finance background, when you look at the return on equity, not just return on investment, at least in my market, the price comparison, the difference between price versus what you can get for rental, by the time I flip a house and I've got a certain amount of equity in it, I would be better off selling it, paying my closing costs, you know, commissions, all that stuff, and then taking what's left over and investing it in a set of apartments that's going to give me a higher percentage of return on that equity as opposed to that tiny amount of, you know, return cash flow that I'm getting by letting that equity sit there in the house. And on the tax side of things, whenever you, because that's the next question I get, well, what about all the taxes that you're getting from the flips? Well, there are huge tax implications, but if you're also buying a lot of apartments, high dollar value real estate, and you're doing cost segregation studies and taking bonus depreciation, you're able to offset most, if not all, of your income from flipping with the, you know, depreciation from the apartments. So that's a long-winded way to, you know, tell you that my method has just been flip single family to buy and hold, you know, multifamily. And I think it's because of podcasts like this that I wasn't afraid to get into multifamily. You know, I had only done like, I think, two deals before I jumped right into buying my first 8-unit building, just because I had heard from these types of podcasts how easy it was to do that. And that I've heard people say on many occasions that it's actually easier to buy a commercial residential property than it is a single family home. And I can confirm that to be true. It was very simple. It was less paperwork. The bank was more concerned with the property and the property's financials than they were with my own. Now, they did still care some about my own and about my experience and whatnot. But now I've, the first 8-unit, I didn't have, you know, the money to put down on that. I paid $450 for it. So I had to put $90,000 down with the commercial mortgage from my local credit union. And so I had a single wide trailer that I had bought 7 months prior for $15,000, a single wide on land. It didn't need any work from a wholesaler. I don't know how they got it that cheap, but I borrowed $15,000 from somebody else so I could buy that. And I originally planned to keep that as a rental. Well, then like 4 months later, I came across this 8-unit apartment deal that was a deal of a lifetime. And so I asked the seller if I could put it under contract with 3 months out for closing to give me time to sell this other property so I could 1031 exchange into that one for the down payment. And he said, yeah, I understand what you're trying to do. That's fine. And so that's what we did. So it was a total of 7 months of owning that single wide trailer to now owning the 8-unit property that today cash flows around $4,000 a month and probably and has almost $1 million in equity in it. So after that property, that was a little over 2 years ago. And then I just kept flipping houses and flipping houses. And then a little over a year ago, I bought a 16-unit 50-50 with a good partner of mine, Chris Monty. That was a seller finance deal, only 8% down, 4% interest, 26-year fixed term with no balloon. I mean, just ungodly terms for a commercial deal, especially. And that property is doing incredible cash flowing like crazy. And then I kept flipping more houses, building more capital. And then July of this year, I with that same partner, I bought a 20 unit that's close to where we live. I'm 65% owner of that one. He's 35, and that one's doing great. And then the very next month, I bought a 15 unit by myself a couple hours away from where I live. That is a full gut rehab. So I'm using all private money on that one. And as soon as we're done with the rehab, we'll refinance or sell it. I'm not 100% sure which one yet. That's how I've grown. I just kept flipping houses to make more money and, you know, using the various methods to buy apartments, whether it's a commercial loan or seller financing or private money, you know? So I think it's just important to stay educated on, you know, all your different options, to have all these different tools in your belt to be able to use whenever these opportunities come along. Because at that time that, you know, we bought that 16 unit seller financed, had we not known about seller financing and how it works and be able to communicate that clearly to the seller, make them feel comfortable, we probably wouldn't have been able to get that deal because I don't think we even had enough capital on hand at that time to have been able to put 20% down if we had to. So, yeah, just being prepared for opportunities and putting in the consistent action to try to keep the liquidity ready for when those opportunities do come along.
Yeah. And now you say you're continuing to flip the single family homes. What pushback or, you know, issues did you have? I mean, obviously rates have begun to lower, but there were, you know, there have been less buying going on in general around the country as the rates had increased. Were you concerned about rates at all? Did you have, you know, longer time that your property was on market, or how did you get through that aspect of the real estate market?
Our area hasn't been as affected as a lot of the country. You know, I'm in the Wilmington, North Carolina market, and for the last, you know, 2 or 3 years, it has, in a few studies, been ranked the number one highest percentage of inbound moves out of, you know, all total moves. So, for example, I think the last study showed that of all moves in or out of Wilmington, 71% were inbound, whereas New York City was the worst on the list, and they were the exact opposite. 71% were outbound. Yeah. So even though Wilmington is kind of a small town, it's a little beach town, there's a lot of people moving here, a lot of people from up north that are retiring here. They vacationed here and fell in love, and now they're buying their retirement home. You know, I've lived here my whole life, and I love it. I don't have any intention on leaving. But because of that, the huge influx of people moving here, there hasn't been a huge slowdown in the market that I've seen. There's been some. There's been a lot less inventory, just like with everywhere else, but there's been even less supply. So prices, for the most part, have still kept going up a little bit, just a little bit slower. But as far as when I'm selling properties, I have seen that instead of having, you know, let's say 3 or 4 competing offers on day 1 or 2 for a property, and some maybe slightly above asking, now it might take me 2, maybe 3 weeks to get a full price offer, you know. But as long as I have priced it correctly, or had my agent price it correctly, and we're patient, you know, we're not desperate, we're not waiting, letting somebody lowball us on the third day or the seventh day, you know, as long as you have a little bit of patience, you'll still get what the property is worth or very, very close to it. But I will say buyers have definitely seem to have gotten pickier over the last year where I'm at, that and more fearful, that they're spending more money per month. They are more afraid of what they're buying, and they're more entitled, I guess, that to a better product because of what they're spending on it. So what I have started trying to do for all of our flips is pre-listing inspections for everything. So a home inspection, if it's on a well and septic tank, then we'll do septic inspections and pumping, and we'll do a well inspection and a water quality test, all that kind of stuff, so that if there are issues, we can go ahead and get those fixed ahead of time, and then we can lay that out in front of all of the potential buyers. My agent can put all of those documents and receipts in the agent remarks on the MLS, so that it does two things, really. First and foremost, it stops the buyers from getting afraid when they get a home inspection that has a bunch of stuff on it and then backing out. Because prior to that, we had several where the buyers would show us this inspection and we would say, okay, we'll fix everything on the inspection report for free. Don't worry about it. And they still back out, even though they have due diligence money on the line, even though we're going to fix all of it for free. And just because they got scared. And so it helps keep contracts intact, and it also gives the buyer less room to try to negotiate. You know, now when we have a buyer come and try to negotiate after an inspection, we just tell them, we already told you that. Yeah, we already told you our inspection, which showed that, and we already told you we're not going to fix that because we don't think it needs to be fixed. It's not necessary. So go kick rocks. We'll keep your due diligence money and sell it to somebody else. And then they stay and they close.
Very nice. Now, you actually achieved your goal. I believe it was in April of 2023. Talk a little bit about when your decision to go full-time real estate, leave corporate America. Because I mean, that's everybody talks about wanting to do that, but taking that step is a massive, I mean, it's kind of a leap in a lot of ways it is, but in some ways it isn't because you're seeing it there. But talk about your mental state as you left corporate America and went full in on real estate.
Yeah. So for me, first and foremost, I just wanted to do it safely. Like I said, I got a family at home. My wife is a stay-at-home mom, and she homeschools the kids, so no income from her side. And I just wanted to make sure we had more than enough rental cash flow coming in so that if the market collapsed and I couldn't flip any more houses for a couple years, neither one of us would have to go back and get a W-2. We would be fine from the rental income. And so that's what I did, and I waited until that time. But, you know, the biggest piece for me is that, you know, I'm a bit contrarian to most real estate investors and entrepreneurs that have all these giant goals and aspirations to build these huge empires and reach a certain door count or a certain dollar figure per month, all these things. To me, I just love doing this, and I'm having the time of my life, and I just want it to stay fun. And because I had the day job and I was doing real estate on the side, there was no pressure on me to perform on the real estate side of things because my day job covered our bills. And so it kept it fun, it kept it light, and there was no pressure on me. Well, I also waited to leave the day job until I no longer needed the real estate income as well. So that way, when I made that transition from day job to full-time real estate investor, there was still no pressure. It was still fun and light. And because to me, once you put pressure on it or that extra responsibility, or even, you know, I know everybody loves to talk about KPIs, key performance indicators, and tracking everything that you're doing on a daily basis. That makes me sick. The thought of all that kind of stuff, I hated school growing up. It was easy for me, but I hated it. It bored the daylights out of me. And anything like that where I'm forcing myself to do it feels like a job, or it feels like homework. And I don't want to have to do that. And sure, maybe if I get to the point where I needed to perform business-wise and I didn't have the passion and drive in me in that moment, and I needed to, you know, install some form of accountability, then, you know, those methods can be fantastic. But if you really love what you're doing and you're passionate about it and you're having fun, I don't think you need those things, because it can take the fun out of it. So there wasn't that much of a change, truthfully. And, you know, as you would probably expect, since I left the day job and have had more time to devote to this, the house flipping business has just exploded. It's just been incredible. Instead of flipping, you know, 4 to 5, 6 houses at a time, you know, now I'm at the moment flipping 13 houses right now. And I love every second of it. And sorry, I got a little excited there.
No, it's good. I love whenever people get excited about real estate and go down that, because I mean, that's one of the big things. I mean, everybody talks about wanting financial independence, but you know, whenever you step away from that W-2 and into the, you know, world of either 1099 or real estate professional, I mean, it's a big, big step. So what would some advice be that you have to an investor who maybe they've either just acquired their first rental or they're considering getting it? Kind of what, I'm assuming you've had conversations with newer investors in your life. Kind of what advice would you give them, or what one thing do you wish somebody had told you whenever you were getting into the space?
You know, I think I would need to know a little bit more about their specific goals first, because some people are fine buying one rental every 3 years until retirement and working their day job, but some people want to scale as quickly as possible so they can quit your day job, you know. But I would almost argue that if you've got that attitude of, man, I hate my job and I don't want to go to work and I want to make money doing something else so I can quit my day job, you're probably not going to be super successful and self-motivated and enough work ethic to do well enough on your own to reach that point. You may want to focus on working really hard in what you're doing and having a good attitude about it and work ethic, you know, and go from there. But, you know, I think if somebody's looking to grow in a similar fashion to how I did, anytime I come across somebody like that, I always encourage them to find some houses to flip. And I don't say that in a way to go out there and be, you know, frivolous about it and buy a bad deal. You know, make sure you know the fundamentals and make sure it's a great deal. And if there's somebody local, usually I'll tell them, like, hey, if you come across a deal, you know, shoot me the address. I'll help you pull comps and look at the pictures, give you my thoughts on the rehab budget, you know, so you can feel a little bit more comfortable, you know. So I would say if you're looking to scale, the easiest way to scale is, in my opinion, to drum up a lot of capital. And if you're not, you know, an anesthesiologist or somebody with a super high W-2 income, then one of the easiest ways out there to drum up a lot of capital is by flipping houses. And one of the biggest reasons that is because of the financing available. I mean, can you imagine if you walked into a bank and said, hey, I want to go buy Coca-Cola stock. Will you loan me 100% of the money to go buy that? They would laugh you right out of the building, right? But with real estate, that's a real thing. As long as you find a good enough deal, you know, on average, if you find a good enough deal to where your purchase price plus your rehab costs don't exceed 70% of the ARV, the after repair value, that's often referred to as the 70% rule, then there are lenders out there that will fund 100% of your purchase price and your rehab. Now, you may have to still come to the table with a little bit of money for your closing costs up front, your points and stuff, you know, and to front the rehab budget if they're doing a draw schedule rather than giving you all the rehab money up front. But, you know, you can find those other sources. If you don't have that money, you know, on my very first flip, I had none of that money. I had to bring about $8,000 to close, and I leveraged a credit card, basically did like cash advances to get that money to do it. And then for the $10,000 rehab, I put the roughly $5,000 of materials on a credit card and had my handyman agree not to get paid until the job was done, and the lender released the $10,000 in the draw to me. You know, so you just have to enjoy the process and be a problem solver. But yeah, any way that you can rapidly increase income is going to be hands down the easiest way to scale things.
All right. Well, fantastic. Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your knowledge with the people. Your website is www.jvwithjv.com. Tell us a little bit about what people will find on that site.
Yeah, so it's just a part of my main Carrot website that homeowners can go to when they're looking to sell a property. I just created a separate little like investors tab on there, which is what this URL will take you to, just in case people want to get up with me, connect with me. If other folks are out there interested in being private lenders or potential equity partners, if I come across a, you know, big enough deal where I need equity partners, that's basically the reason I created that, just, you know, for people to be able to connect.
All right. Well, fantastic. Again, the website is jvwithjv.com. Don't forget, if you have any questions you want us to answer in future episodes, please send them to podcasts@renttoretirement.com. That's podcasts@renttoretirement.com. And Zach and I will address them in those episodes. And you can always check us out at renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com. You can schedule a call with us. You can see our inventory there. You can talk with us about how to scale your portfolio and how to get you where you want to go. Thank you so much for educating yourselves today, and we'll talk to you on the next episode.